Good evening.
Good evening, Michael. Good evening.
This talk is about the second commitment, taking care of one another. And it covers a fair amount of the material, particularly in two of the chapters, but not so much in the very last one, which is called The Catalyst for Compassion. We'll have just a little bit to say about that. So first, the ground. The second commitment, committing to take care of one another so as to alleviate the suffering of all sentient beings, even if one does not like how that feels, is firmly based on the first commitment, refraining from any speech or action that causes harm to anyone, oneself or another. So this does not mean that the three commitments can be taken as sequential steps. That is, we could complete the first commitment, then we could do the second commitment, and then we could do the third, whatever that turns out to be. It would be much better if we used the image of a pyramid, each commitment resting firmly on the previous one. The first commitment, not causing harm, is the foundation. It may never be completed in this lifetime. Still, it must serve as the basis for the second commitment, alleviating the suffering of all beings. Even while we continue to work on the first, even while we have to continue to work on the first throughout the rest of our life. The first commitment teaches us that we can begin to lean into new, edgy, uncomfortable experiences without immediately retreating into our comfort zone. We might retreat, but we have learned that we can keep touching into groundlessness, keep touching a little more and a little more, and not run away, or at least not run away and shut down and never come back. We will keep trying. So without this confidence as a foundation, it would be very hard to even start the second commitment without being completely terrorized and having no idea how to handle it. So the way I've imaged the pyramid, the first is the base of the pyramid, and it's sitting there and providing the basis for the second, which will sit on top of it. And the second will be supported by the first. The second commitment is deeply related to bodhicitta, the longing that is already existing within us to go beyond the limits of our conventional fears and limitations, and we shall return to that. But first I would like to quote Pema Chodron, because she is so good at just throwing us directly into the water. So I'm going to read. Or someone else can read if they have the book and want to read it. I guess I can read it.
I read. Which page are we looking at, Michael?
I'm looking at page 67, and it's a whole paragraph. Okay. The commitment to take care of one another.
Okay.
You want to read it?
Sure. The commitment to take care of one another is often described as a vow to invite all sentient beings to be our guest. The prospect can be daunting. It means that everyone will be coming to our house. It means opening our door to everyone, not just to the people we like, or the ones who smell good, or the ones we consider proper, but also to the violent ones and the confused ones, to people of all shapes, sizes, and colors, to people speaking all different languages, to people with all different points of view. Making the second commitment means holding a diversity party in our living room all day, every day, until the end of time. Well, that sounds fun.
What?
Get me off this
boat. Sounds like a good start, doesn't it?
It's an amazing paragraph.
So, how can we possibly handle this?
That's the question.
Really big house.
And once again, I am going to quote Pema. This time I'll read. Initially, most of us are in no way ready to commit to all that. We are in no way ready to leap into that much groundlessness without reservation. But if we have a longing to alleviate suffering, what can we do? For one thing, we can invite everybody and open the door to them all, but open the door only briefly at first. We open it only as long as we're able to, and close it when we feel too uncomfortable. However, our aspiration is always to open the door again and to keep it open for a few seconds longer than the time before. So that is her recommendation for not trying to do what we can't do. Do what we can do. Keep coming back to it and touch it a little more each time. So it's very easy to break the second vow. We do it whenever we close our heart and mind to anyone, even briefly. We do it if we denigrate ourselves, saying, I'm hopeless, I'll never get it. We break it if we criticize anyone's culture, tradition, or belief. Any form of bigotry or bias breaks the vow. So it's almost impossible not to break the vow. Surprisingly, according to Pema, she says that when we break the second vow, it is easy to mend. That's surprising, isn't it? It reminds me of saying that meditation is very easy because if you forget the instructions, you just go back to it. So, if we break the vow, we acknowledge that we broke the vow. We acknowledge that we broke this commitment, and then we reaffirm our intention to keep the doors open to everyone for the rest of our life, and then we just go on with our business.
I had an interesting experience with this last week, that a man came to church last week. Where was here. And someone brought him in and said, he's looking for food, he's really hungry. And so I started getting him food, and I had a container of soup that I brought to give to a friend. And I kept thinking, and he was homeless, and he was very particular and wanted essentially vegan food.
He was vegan.
I had this, and I kept thinking I could offer him the soup, and I didn't.
Was it vegan?
It was vegan. No, it was. He would have let, although he wouldn't let you microwave it, so I don't know how good it would have been. Cold, but I could have heated it up. But there was that, I was finding all kinds of things from him and trying to be really kind and help, and yet this was like my soup that I made. You know, but it was just that piece of, like...
Mm-hmm. I will tell you, he would have had to read every ingredient.
I made it, I could have told him exactly.
I know, but he...
He's very particular. Well, I didn't know, but I'm saying, I didn't know that, Roberta. I knew that I thought it would be okay, and I never offered it to him. So it's just very interesting to have, like, I went this far, and then I felt myself stop repeatedly. And I noticed it, and it was like, that's as far as I could open the drawer.
You know. I think it's okay. I think a lot of people open the door to this.
But it was just interesting to see where it's like...
Where your line was.
Where in you.
Where the line was in me. And it was like, I hadn't told this person I was bringing the soup, so it wasn't like... I'd promised, and then, and she would have been fine if I promised, and I said, this other person needed it, I'll bring you some others, or even I don't have for you. Yeah. But it's just, but that.
I had an experience last week, too, where I went to dinner with a friend of mine and her husband, and her husband, I said a couple of things implying that I'm fairly liberal in my politics, and at dinner her husband asked me, they've been for Trump, and he's a real Trumper. And we got in this discussion about, he was like, why do you guys hate us? Why? It's like you won't even talk to us. And it was so uncomfortable. And I felt myself like him less.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm still uncomfortable because he's been kind to me, right? They've both been very supportive of me and kind to me, but I felt myself go, I don't want to hang out with them anymore, and I hope no one takes any of this personally. But it was tough because he was saying a lot of things that matter to me just don't matter to him, and it was I felt under attack almost. It was
anyhow. It sounded like he attacked you a little bit.
Well, I think a little bit, but it wasn't his intent.
Yeah.
You know, I know that he was really just curious to understand why we're so divided as a nation. And a lot of folks can't talk to people on the opposite side of that fence anymore. You know, he felt like I was a safe place, which is a big compliment. But at the same time, I was really maybe not so safe.
But it does raise the question, what do we mean to let everyone in?
It's tough, I think. I
mean, what does that look like, really?
Because everybody's everybody, right?
Everybody is everybody.
But I mean...
They mention the violent ones in that paragraph.
Yeah. Smelly ones.
The smelly ones. I mean, it's everybody.
You just mean about the homeless people all the time, but, you know, talking about smelly, and there's a guy this afternoon with his girlfriend was just attacking the whole staff, and everybody just wanted him to leave. And he kept saying, I'll go and kill myself like I did before. I just, you know, there wasn't anything that you could do that was going to be enough.
I think sometimes, like in, like with Elisa's situation too, it's not, at least with me, some, you know, you don't know maybe how a person's going to react. You know, it isn't always about should I or shouldn't I do it, or I want to do it, but it gets to be a little more complicated sometimes when you are approaching someone who potentially might have some mental health issues or, you know, things like this that you don't know what that interaction is going to be like.
The staff just ended up hating this guy. I mean, it was really bad. You know,
I think Yasmina is up.
Right. No, you know, I'm from Sri Lanka, which is predominantly Buddhist, though I wasn't born, I was born Muslim. And so but I heard a lot of, you know, Buddhism is all around, and the spiritual path, the steps, you know, it's like a chant. It's called Dana Sila Bhavana, which means generosity, morality, and then meditation. And it always, you know, used to intrigue me, how is it that generosity comes before morality? You know, that's the and now, you know, and I think in a sense this is my understanding, is So in being generous, we see the other person, right? Whether it doesn't necessarily mean materially generous. It can be materially generous, that giving up, yeah. And that morality, like you said, the pyramid, that the morality is based on that ability to see and extend ourselves outwards to others, right? So that's my understanding. So the practice of generosity is very much a part of, you know, what we're supposed to do. Right, the dana is in Sri Lanka. They all, you know, they don't do it perfectly. Nobody does, but it's so that, you know.
Yeah,
it means, you know.
Well, this is really interesting. If you don't mind, we had a situation here where there was someone who felt very threatening to some of us, dangerous even. And here we are, all working with this. Trying to be as open and really working with how do we apply these to our lives. And yet we have to make a judgment call. Are we safe? Are we not safe? How does this, it raises the issue of how on the ground does this, what does this look like on the ground in terms of the way we let people into our living room? Or not. You can want to be generous, but you can also be a damn fool.
True, but if we can be generous in our spirit, in the sense that you are not a person that, you know, that violent person. I used to, you know, work with the mentally ill. That was my career. And so there were very many times when you had to say, no, you cannot be here, or we have to call the police. But what does it mean to say we have to call the police, but that doesn't mean I reject you as a person? Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to be in a different place. Mm-hmm. I can't be in the same room with you. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I was able to do it all the time, but that was the goal. Mm-hmm. Or,
right. In the case that Erica was mentioning,
organization call. Yeah?
Yeah, I was there. I made the judgment call. I made it wrong. Completely wrong. And then I found myself in a situation where I could not explain to that person why I had made it wrong. I simply had to absorb the situation. There was nothing I could do. I could not say, well, I'm sorry, I did something wrong. Because for other reasons, I was not in a position to be able to do that. So one gets into situations and they can be damn difficult.
I think that's a path part.
Yeah.
Has to be.
No, I'm just going to say this. You know, Sharon Salzberg has this in her book. She was in Calcutta once in a rickshaw or something, and the rickshaw man was trying to do something to her, you know, like attack orchid. And she had gone back to her guru, you know, like the mentor, and asked, what should I have done? He said, with all the love you had, you should take on your umbrella and hit him.
Yeah.
You know, that's what she was, you know. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So we talk about idiot compassion. Yeah. Right.
So that's prajna.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's not like, you know, you have sort of these high ideals and then you're trapped by them. It's actually, in any situation, a certain thing may be the correct action that right. may be a sharp cutting of the situation.
I think Erica mentioned it once when we discipline our children. Mm-hmm. You know, we spank them with, you know, like give them shot in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, we don't feel that, you know,
right.
that hatred or that disgust. It's just that, you know, you just need to be in the corner today. You can't, you know,
it's the right action.
It's whatever, but it doesn't mean you can't be in the living room, no matter.
I think that's the essence, is not, you said, not cutting yourself off entirely and feeling they're not a human being, just with this Trump thing and everything. Just that there's this, you might even feel distaste or something, but there's still this sense that you're in there with them and they're a person and you are. And
just so we're saying, I think I mirror, most of the folks I've talked to mirror back my thoughts, right?
Yeah.
So and we share the same philosophy. So, but I think that's right. It makes you kind of wake up a little bit and go, "Gosh, There are people who are nice who still, like, I don't understand.
But it may be that you, if they go over a line, yeah, and start doing something that feels attacking to you, to, yeah, just assert and say, I that's making me uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I did at one point say, we shouldn't talk about this anymore.
Right.
Because that was a little much, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but it just, I still have been struggling all mm-hmm. week with mm-hmm. with my reaction to it, I guess.
There's a whole, just to mention, there's a whole bunch of groups now. In fact, I'm taking one at my temple. It's called Difficult Conversations, and it's exactly that point. And it's a whole curriculum. I could, you know,
that's fascinating. Yeah, that would be
so
great.
Many people are struggling with this.
Yeah, another friend of mine is too. She's like, I'm not talking about therapists. I don't know how to manage in this world anymore. You know, because
I mean, I think we all are.
It's
yeah,
so
we
different.
Are. Yeah, we are. This is such a ripe topic yeah. right now. That you know, we all have friends on either side yeah. of the aisle, so yeah. to speak. But, you know,
that's why Tonglen, actually, that we just did is fascinating because it can be done on the spot.
Yeah,
and it is a cure-all, but it remarkably aerates the situation. So that claustrophobia, because you're taking in your own confusion, because mm-hmm. that's at play there.
Yeah.
It isn't just that person. It's like this dynamic is...
And he was confused too. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
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 Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it is. And yeah. I think it's good that he could bring it up.
Yeah.
Everybody is avoiding it.
Everyone is.
So I think it's...
His wife was horrified.
I think it's to his credit and your credit that, you know, so that in itself is a practice.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that he felt comfortable enough.
Yeah.
And that even though maybe we all overreact in the situation, it is something to kind of stop for a moment if we can, because everybody is avoiding it. And it's the elephant in the room everywhere mm-hmm. these mm-hmm. days. So
yeah.
it's I think it's a good thing to think about.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, I thought about it a lot more lately. About the
Well, I think yeah. especially right now.
Well, for sure.
Right now.
I heard something recent, like something on television, I can't really explain it all that well, but it was just saying that in times past, we used to all talk about like differences in like Democrats, Republicans, Independents based on like if you believed in more taxes or less taxes or more about the economy, but now it's all about like our value systems have taken over. You know, so it kind of gets back to, we talked in here about our identities, our personal identities, and so we're kind of all up, you have this identity, your values are clashing with, and so politics has just gotten so much more intense.
More personal.
Yeah. Personal yeah. than it ever was.
Yeah.
I was thinking the other day, it's what the climate was like in at the time of war, and when there's a common enemy, all of a sudden, I would think that it would bring people together because they're trying to survive against some kind of outside threat. I don't know, it just popped in my mind today, you know, how everything we're...
Don't,
yeah, there's
don't tell him about that.
No, I know, then he'll think of something like that, yeah, exactly. I don't know, it's probably irrelevant to the conversation, but I just sort of, I'm just trying to understand.
And how to have conversations,
right.
you know, with people who think so differently.
I was thinking, because actually I should bring this up in the group on them. The biggest conflict, I think, and I've had this situation, is if there's someone that you really love, that you really care about, a friend,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that you, and that I wonder what it would be like to, I haven't done this, but I wonder what it would be like to express a feeling like, I am so troubled because these things that I believe in are so important to me, and I really care about you and like you, and I've been kind to you, you've been kind to me, and I'm having so much trouble with this, and I'm actually really curious. And then to step back and say, I'm wondering where, like, what something like why you support, you know, what, and right. and just really try to listen, and you don't, it doesn't mean you have to agree,
yeah.
or you know, change your own opinion, but to acknowledge a struggle that it's kind of like, oh, how can I like someone that feels so differently than me? And you know,
it's tough because it's for me at least, it was very kind of comforting almost to start pigeonholing those answers, right? White male fear, right? I mean, you can just make your own story without really listening. I think that's the whole key. You have to really be open.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
Well, it does come back to this, how are we taking care of each other?
Okay.
With this, I mean, how can we take care of one another?
Yeah.
I mean, you care about him, he cares about you, so how is this divide? How are we not taking care of? Because there really are deep feelings here. And people are drifting away, even in families, people are drifting. It is causing a drift.
Mm-hmm.
So how are we going to take care of one another? Not just in the nation, but in families and friends. You can feel it drifting. I mean, there's no question.
It's getting
about
worse,
it.
I think.
It is. So how are we going to do this?
It's hard to know.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael knows the answer.
Michael's going to give us. Michael's going to give us.
I don't have any answer, but we're supposed to talk a bit about this book, and the next chapter we have to cover is Tanglin. And I assume you have practiced it, and you have, most of you have probably read what's in this book too. So Tanglin is a core practice for warriors in training. That is, as warriors, our work is to go beyond the fears and the limitations that keep us trapped in our sense of separation and personal concerns. We all have within us this bodhicitta which wants to go beyond this. It's there. It's not something we can import. It's already there. And asking that we recognize it. Tanglin helps us transcend our worldly concerns. Does anyone want to volunteer briefly to recall some of the worldly concerns and how they're going to arise in the practice? There are a couple of them that are hit us right at the start.
So there are eight of them, right? And there are pairs.
There are four pairs, yeah.
Okay.
Gain and loss.
That's not the ones at the beginning, though.
That's okay. It doesn't matter.
Pain and pleasure. The very first one.
Right.
And that's going to hit us right away.
Right.
And we heard disrepute.
Fame and disrepute.
Fame and disrepute.
Yeah, that kind of hits us. Maybe
blame,
a little
bit. Praise and blame.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah, right?
And pleasure and pain.
Yeah. Possibly before that we have gain, loss and gain, which is the really critical one here, because loss can mean loss of money, loss of status, loss of position in society, loss of health, loss of confidence. There are all kinds of losses we could encounter. And the opposite of that is gain, what we'd like to hold on to, what we don't want to give away. Even if we can't hold on to it, we don't want to give it away, it seems. So bodhicitta is the longing within us to awaken and transcend our world of fear, hesitation, and limited sense of self. Tanglin is a practical tool, and I think that's a key point here. Tanglin is a practical tool to provoke our sense of bodhicitta, our sense of warriorship. Tonglen is always practiced riding the breath, and we had a little bit of talk about that earlier. And it can be practiced while we're sitting in a meditation hall, and it can be practiced in the midst of a very difficult situation in which we're right on the spot. But in any case, the practice is riding the breath, and the practice is always to give away what we most would like to hold on to. To take on ourselves what we don't like, and to give out what we like. And that is always the practice, and that is always guaranteed to provoke trouble, right? We know that. It turns our habitual patterns upside down, makes trouble. We breathe in whatever we do not want for ourselves and breathe out what we most want to hold on to or wish we could hold on to. The Tonglen is always personal. If we have just learned that we have a fatal cancer, then we breathe in that fear. We take that fear into ourselves and give out to others, including others who also have just learned that they have a fatal cancer. And there are lots of them. We will not run out of candidates. We give to others equanimity, good health, or if nothing else, simply the strength of mind to accept this condition and manage it. There are innumerable beings who, like us, have just encountered this unwanted affliction. We may love some of them. We may hate some of them. There are plenty of them we don't even know about. We don't even know they exist. So we will not run out of customers. There are always people to whom we can take in what we don't want and give out whatever it is we want.
I had a comment. Yes. That, because Emily introduced me to Tonglen quite a number of years ago at this point. And so I've done a lot and listened to different instructions. And I liked when Joseph talked about it maybe about a year ago and said, you shouldn't decide what you're sending to people necessarily, because that's about yourself. So it's sort of sending whatever they would need. And the thing that hit me one time when I was doing it for a student who was really challenging and was fairly disruptive in my class, and he really had a very, very difficult situation. I mean, there was no question that there were reasons he was challenging. And I was sitting one day breathing in like all the struggles he has, and I'm doing the like, what will I send out to him? And my brain goes, I'll send out to him that he will like to sit down and do all my work. Well, that's all about me, isn't it? Oh, wow, that's like not seeing the other person at all. This is never me. And I like the idea of like totally pulling myself out and just saying, wishing that person what would be good for them and not assuming that I know what that is. Because the truth is, I don't really, like, I know the situation for what's been described to me, but I don't know, for each person, I don't know what the suffering is. I know that, like me, this would be, you know, for me, this would be really hard. I'm assuming all these things going on in his life are hard, but maybe there's even more, and maybe there's pieces of it that are, for him, are particularly hard. And so I think, I always felt like that freed me from, like, trying to figure out, like, what would I wish, or when I did it for, like, friends whose children were dying, like, what would you send?
So I fear that I may be, that I may become senile. And if I breathe that in and accept that this can be happening to me, and maybe it is happening to me, I do not know what I can offer to other people who might have this fear. Whether I can offer them a huge future of clarity of mind and no senility, or simply wish that some kind of acceptance comes to them if that is the case. And I feel it's the same type of situation. I don't know what I can offer to other people in that situation. And since this is one that I am working with, I thought I would bring it up. So we've had people here who have experienced the loss of their parents, and I don't know whether it's appropriate or not appropriate to either ask for something or give something, but if you do have something you want to say at this point, you're welcome to. You don't, certainly don't have to.
I was going to share that after my mom died, and people, you know, people send you cards, and people would send cards with, like, the, I'm so sorry for your loss, which, you know, is like not this deep, powerful thought. And it would make me cry because it was so kind. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think you, certain things put you in a place where you suddenly realize how kind other people are. Mm-hmm. Because you need it so much. And so in some sense, it doesn't really matter what they wish you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you don't realize.
It's
like
just the communication.
Just, I, you know, because it's kind of, I wish for you to be well, I want you to know you're loved. Mm-hmm. And they know, you know, like you talked about Michael, like if you're going to develop dementia, like the good wishes may not change that. But the knowing about the good wishes changes your heart. Mm. Because it sees that it's loved, and it can feel that, but it, you know, that's sort of what hit me. I was sort of astonished.
Yeah, I agree. Went through it just a week ago. It's not even the words that matter, it's sort of showing up. Right. Or, you know, there are some people that I expected. So we had Shiva for several days, and that's very, very powerful. What was meaningful, the people that I expected to show up, there were some in the community that weren't close friends, and they showed up, and it was really special. Yeah. And, It's just the idea that you're not in it alone, which right. I think is maybe mm-hmm. the whole point of the second and third. But that people care. It's so easy to forget that. I mean, because we just get in our own little worlds and.
And I think some of the key thing that you said, at least to me, is the whole act of us showing up.
Yeah,
you know, it's so easy for us not to do that.
Right.
Like you know, be it not to show up again for your friend who talked to you like that, or, you know, to sit back and do nothing.
Like it's
you
so
know,
easy.
But if you can,
yeah.
Yeah, you, and the you take some energy to do that.
Right.
You know, be it in, I mean, I guess it takes, it can take many different forms, you know. Show yes. up at service, show up in a letter, show up in
oh,
a
so much food showed up. showed up.
Why am I not surprised?
I was saying, it's so easy to cut ourselves off from other people.
Yeah.
And to be so easy to be offended and so easy with whether it's a difference in opinion or anything. I mean, some people are less sensitive than others. I have a feeling that that we are gravitate here because maybe we are on the sensitive side of things.
Well, people's illnesses isolate them too.
That's
I mean,
true.
People shut down in all different kinds or isolate in all different for all different reasons.
Yeah.
And it isn't a nobody knows. They're just not there.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Michael, I want to thank you for your generosity, your big out-breath that you just gave to us, actually, by mentioning your own situation as an enormous generates an enormous amount of space and relaxation and kindness. So, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Does anyone want to have the basic on the Christian instruction repeated, simply read?
Is there sure.
It's a great Tongmen, you mean?
Yes, the Tongmen instruction. It's very straightforward. Michael, would you like to read it, please? It's on page 86. Just read it.
Yeah, I'll get to it. As a general guideline, we start Tonglen practice with the situation that is immediate and real, not something vague or impersonal. Then we extend it to include more and more beings who are suffering in a similar way, as well as all of us suffering from ego clinging, all of us suffering from resistance to uncertainty and impermanence. If we ourselves have had even a glimmer of what egolessness feels like, of what awakening feels like, of what freedom feels like, then we want that for others too. When we see that they're hooked, instead of being critical and judgmental, we can empathize with what they're going through. We've been there and know exactly how they feel. Our wish for other people is the same as our wish for ourselves. To appreciate ourselves, to recognize when we're caught and disentangle ourselves from those feelings, to stop reinforcing the dysfunctional patterns that prolong our suffering, to reach out to others, to experience the goodness of being human. Whether we do Tonglen as a formal practice or on the spot, does it time take you to get used to? Yes, it does. Does it take getting accustomed to the rawness of pain? Yes. Does it take the patience and gentleness? Yes, it does. There's no need to get discouraged when the practice seems too hard. Allow yourself to ease into it slowly at your own pace, working first with situations that are easy for you right now. I always remember what Chögyam Trungpa used to say when I was losing my confidence and wanted to give up. He'd sit up tall and smile broadly and proclaim, "You can do it!" Somehow his confidence was contagious, and when I heard these words, I knew I could. I once read a poem about practicing Tonglen in a time of war. The imagery was of breathing in bombs falling, violence, despair, losing your legs and coming home with your face burned and disfigured, and then sending out the beauty of the earth and sky, the goodness of people, safety and peace. In the same spirit, we can breathe in hatred and jealousy, envy and addiction, all the sorrow of the human drama, using our personal experience of that pain and extending Tonglen to all others caught in the same way. Then we can breathe out flexibility, lightheartedness, non-aggression, strength, whatever we feel will bring comfort and upliftedness and relief. The pain of the world pierces us to the heart, but we never forget the goodness of being alive. Chögyam Trungpa once said, "The problem with most people is that they're always trying to give out the bad and take in the good." That has been the problem of society in general and the world altogether. The time has come for us to try the opposite approach, to take in the bad and give out the good. Compassion is not a matter of pity or the strong helping the weak. It's a relationship between equals, one of mutual support. Practicing Tonglen, we come to realize that other people's welfare is just as important as our own. In helping them, we help ourselves. In helping ourselves, we help the world.
Thank you. So, let's be... Actually, there is...
We have some time.
There is time here, actually. I'm glad
it's
this.
Spacious.
This is like it's
time for an hour.
Nice. Yeah, I'm even a little surprised that I haven't run out of time here. But does someone have something to say, or should I go on to very briefly the third part?
You could go on, unless does someone, anyone else, have any contribution so far? Okay.
So I didn't really want to say very much about this. I think I'm going to leave it till next week. And who has to handle that?
Erica.
Erica. Okay.
Chapter 8, mainly, I guess. The Bodhisattva, or
it's called The Catalyst for Compassion, is
okay.
The title of the chapter, yeah.
Okay.
And yes, it is about that. So this is the conclusion for the second commitment. And actually there's quite a bit of material that Pema makes. There's this story about Captain whoever.
Courageous.
Yeah, which doesn't turn me on, but if it turns you on, go read it. But a very key point being made is that each time we reverse our habitual behavior, each time we succeed in saying, "I'm renewing this commitment and I will keep this commitment," it goes beyond our conscious intention. It permeates into our unconscious strength to actually have the courage to go beyond. So in that way, we're reinforcing bodhicitta in a manner that is really very powerful. We are living in a very frightening and very unpredictable and very dangerous time in this world. I think everyone knows that. It hardly needs any elaboration. None of us know from moment to moment what can happen, what horrors can be inflicted, what terrors we might personally have to face that will throw us out of any momentary comfort we are currently enjoying. This chapter... And I don't know where Pema gets this exactly, but she talks about three different ways of being in the world, and maybe we can go over that in the next time. The thought I would like to leave you with is that no matter what we think we might do, or how we're going to handle unpredictable situations, we just don't know. And I'm going to tell you a story that I remember because it happened. I remember it happening, and it was about perhaps 20 years ago. And it concerned a man who was a neurosurgeon, which is to say he was highly trained, he fully qualified, had an excellent reputation, and was highly respected as someone who could perform surgery on the brain of a living human. And one Sunday, he found himself having rented a... Now, I'm sure if someone had said, do you think unqualified people should be allowed to do neurosurgery? No one ever asked him that. Of course, he would have said, no, you have to be qualified. You have to know what you're doing. So on this particular Sunday, he very happily rented a backhoe, which can dig trenches, and was digging a trench across the front of his own suburban house. And in fact, he did not know what he was doing. No one had told him that you don't do that unless you call an organization called
DigSafe.
DigSafe. And he had not done that.
That's not the gas lines. You don't have the gas lines.
He had not done that. And he ripped open the gas line. And there was the gas pouring into the basement of his house. He saw what he had done instantly. He was no dummy. He was highly intelligent. He knew that when the gas reached the point where it hit the flame of the furnace or some other source, it would surely explode the entire house. Very fortunately, his wife and his children were not home. But his mother was home on the third floor. Now, what did this man do? Did he say, I'm going to analyze what's best in the interest of everyone, and perhaps it would be better to sacrifice her because it wouldn't be good if my children became orphans? No, he did nothing of the sort. He had no idea what he was going to do. What he did was to run up to the third floor. He carried his mother out of the house, into the backyard, across the backyard to where there was a low stone fence between his property and the neighbor on the other side, the other street. He pushed her down, out of harm's way, and got himself down. Then he got out his cell phone, after having done all this, called 911 and said, this house is about to explode. Boom! I'm too late. The house has exploded. And that's as far as the story goes. And something happened. I don't know what, but no one got killed. He survived. His mother survived.
Well, that's good.
But if we think we know what we're going to do, I think we're mistaken. We don't. And that's why I mentioned this.
Damn, that's quite a story.
One day after Halloween.
You want to say something? You're welcome. I'm through saying anything.
Comment. So I know we're constantly talking about how we're in the scariest, most dangerous time in history, and I agree in terms of the future of the planet. However, I believe that from the beginning of time, from minute to minute, one never knew what was going to happen to oneself or one's family. It could be killed, eaten by a lion, fall off a cliff, starve to death. The actual experience of this uncertainty and
living beautifully with uncertainty
and change. That's the human condition.
That's right. Yeah.
And that it really, from a personal basis, I think it's really no more uncertain or more dangerous than it's ever been. Now, that's all. Well, I mean, I know the planet is more, our whole planet
is more at risk probably than ever before. But
I think that's well said.
Individually, it's individually, Tom, it's just as dangerous.
Well, no, I was just going to comment on that. I mean, statistically, this is actually the safest time in the history of the world to live.
Yeah.
It just seems worse because of, you know,
the internet
and 24-hour news cycle. And, and I mean, it is true. I mean, like, a lot of these media outlets and things just play on fear of people. And it makes it seem like, I mean, like, for example, your child is much less likely to get kidnapped than it was in the 1980s or the 1960s, or if you go further back. But yet people hold their children so much closer, right? And when I was growing up, we just played outside. And so there's a perception. I think there really is a perception, because all you do is, I mean, again, it's nonstop news, and you just see all the terrible things
But I think there's also a piece of, we've been convinced that we could be made safe. Like, you know, 200 years ago, people knew, like, your child could get sick and die in a day, you know?
Yeah.
You could fall down and hurt yourself and you'd be useless and they wouldn't feed you, whatever. You know, that there was no sense of safeness and certainty. And now for us, for not everyone, and for a lot of people, this isn't even like they've never imagined it. But, you know, it's like, I think about, like, when Katrina came to New Orleans, I got freaked out because I thought, I have all this stuff, I have my whole life that's so organized, and it could go like that if I lived in a certain place, like the people in Houston had that, like they had this whole setup. Even different, like, not just your home, but, like, your whole community could get washed away. Mm-hmm. And we're like, we're not used to that because we've gotten to this place of feeling comfort and safety, and people don't come attack us and steal our stuff, and our children don't die suddenly.
Yeah, we have political freedoms, we have religious freedoms, we have a lot of things now that are new to us, right? New in the world, I think.
I remember reading about how when Emily Dickinson was growing up, like, everybody was used to childhood death.
I mean, that was very common.
They had friends that died.
Yeah, like one out of three.
Father lost a sister. I mean, it was very...
Yeah, if you go, I just took a course on Mount Auburn Cemetery, which is a fabulous place, by the way. And it was, the woman talked about all these different deaths of children. It was so common, and there was, you know, all these different diseases that would just run through communities, and thousands, so many people would just be dead.
People would have 8, 10, 12 kids. They did not expect all of them.
No.
They didn't expect all of them.
A lot of people lost like a third of their children. And, many more births. But,
and so many women did not survive.
No, childbirth was very dangerous. Childbirth and burning in fire.
But this is still happening all around the world.
Yes.
But I always think, you know, people say, oh, it was better years ago. And I was thinking, my mother was born, women couldn't vote. This is bad. It's huge.
And even in the world,
I don't feel particularly safe. I was at a class.
You're not.
I'm not. I was at a class in Brandeis, and there was this device in the room that all of a sudden started freaking out and talking, and someone ran out with it.
That was me.
You ran out. Yeah, okay.
It was your wife.
Okay, but at this moment, I had no idea whether or not whatever terrorism hit that temple and killed I don't know how many Jewish people and wounded others. I didn't know whether or not Brandeis had just been hit like that, okay? It could happen at any moment, and I don't feel safe.
You know, I understand what you're talking about, Michael, but I had an experience this week with watching the Red Sox games. I was in New York, I came back, my husband and his brother were watching the Red Sox.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I came in at the last game to watch the game. You know, had my glass of wine, all excited to watch the game. And I thought, you know, his brother's there with his computer, and they're looking at all the statistics and knew who was coming up to bat and every little piece of information.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, okay. And his brother's daughter has anorexia, and, you know, there's all this stuff, you know, in life going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew that they just wanted to be there and watch the game.
Right.
You know, like, don't even bring up anything about the world around you. Right. It was just a good, it was a good experience for me because I just, you know, I mean, I would hope that I wouldn't go down that path of just talking about Trump or whatever, but you can see how we all are so caught up with this. Mm-hmm. And so what I tried to do, and did, and his brother did bring up on his own about his daughter, but just to sit there and enjoy it, you know, and not, and just be there for what it was. It was the World Series, the last game, and I don't know, it was just a slice of nice, you know, in this world of that we're all walking around with this all the time. And I don't know, that was kind of an aha moment for me, you know, that I don't do that. You know, I don't really just go and let all this just go.
Well, I suggest that also it's possible when things are really like in a state of uncertainty and chaos or collapsing, you know, the kind of cushions that we are used to expecting in terms of making life bearable is actually an extraordinary opportunity to just be open to right now. So we talked about absolute bodhicitta and the whole notion of what it can mean to just be here completely, unconditionally. And somehow that can help work with the kind of fears that often are very justified about issues that could be threatening us. I mean, for instance, if you're Jewish, then you're seeing a whole rise of anti-Semitism, and that you realize, well, I'm one of those targets. I mean, who knows? Because nobody really, I don't know if everybody's keeping track of who is or who isn't Jewish, but, you know, it's one of the things that collectively build up from the past, and you have that. And then there's all these other things about, I know there's an incredible amount of unending injustice in this world. You know, there are so many different issues that are being brought up right now, and they all want to be addressed, and they all need to be addressed. But at the same time, if we aren't really, we can't allow ourselves, I mean, as practitioners, to just get completely lost by those fears, whether they're personal or collective, but actually work with it on the spot. And, you know, if we actually do that and we just rest in it, even if it's just momentary, we can discover something that's fundamentally positive, fundamentally spacious. And, you know, it's absolutely necessary when you realize that things are happening like this, that to be able to take advantage of, for instance, getting teachings about being able to work with that instead of just going to pieces, because we cannot control. No matter who we are, we can't control fate. We don't know who's going to do something, even if, let's say, anti-Semitism, for instance, were completely a piece of history. There's always going to be some crazy guy out there or person who decides they have to get rid of people who are Jewish. You know, I mean, it's just an example. I think the important thing is that somehow recognizing that this fundamental sanity is available to us as our own nature, and that we need to really develop a connection and an experience and a sense of faith and confidence in that so that we can weather these kinds of high uncertainties and really scary and threatening kinds of moments. Yes, Michael?
No, I think
Erica. I was just thinking, because of all this, what an odd juxtaposition. Who was I talking with? You, I think. I don't remember. But this terrible, horrible, yet another horrible massacre at the temple, side by side with the Sox winning.
Yeah,
but
the what?
With the Red Sox winning. It's sort of like you're like,
yeah,
I don't know how to be, you know. I'm incredibly, it's incredibly cool. It's incredibly terrible.
You should know you're Jewish.
Of course, that's what I'm trying to say.
It's always that
way.
But this is, you break the glass.
if you're too happy, you're afraid something's going to happen.
Well, yeah. But they both are hanging out in the same moment is what I'm trying to say.
That's life. That's I think we're all getting to that point, too.
Okay. Does anyone else wish to have...
Yeah, we're all Jewish.
Does anyone else wish to have the last word?
Okay, you're going to have the last word?
No, I don't want
to. The two things I think about the Buddha. One is he said, I teach only one thing, suffering and the overcoming of suffering. Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the names he's known by is the happy one.
The happy one.
There you go.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good. Yeah. Thank you.
Well done. That's
thank you.
Good. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, excellent.